And when she came back, she told me that, you know, mom had taken her and she had had an abortion. I didn't even know, like I said, I was a country boy. I didn't even know what an abortion was. I had to look it up.
Marcy, pop quiz. What's a word that starts with S and it means help spread the pro-life message? I'll give you a hint. It starts with S and ends with subscribe.
Oh, people should subscribe to Dear Jane to stay in the loop on all the awesome conversations we're having, like the one today.
Oh, yeah. Today's is awesome. I don't know if people know this, but we have new episodes every Thursday.
Yep.
Every week we've got a new episode, new conversation, new thoughts, every Thursday we're doing this. And so if you want to be made aware of when the new, you know what the kids say when they say, when the new episode drops.
Drops,
then
that's what it is.
You need to subscribe, hit the button, whatever you got to do on your platform. Then just getting a little friendly notice, hey, new Dear Jane, check it out. That would really help spread the pro-life message, and we would really appreciate that. And then you can check out our new website, DearJane.org, and we're on the socials too. So let's work together to help spread the pro-life message, and we'll all be better for it. So today, man, what a great conversation. You know, we've talked about before on here the challenge with the Black community and helping to spread the pro-life message, helping them understand the history of Planned Parenthood, how it was really set up as race eradication almost, you know. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to ever talk about that. But man, who we talked to today is just really dynamic, and it's going to be fun.
Yep. You're going to love it. It's a dynamic duo, husband and wife team. Just real powerhouses in the state of Louisiana and even beyond, yep. Taking their work nationally. I think you're going to love it. So tune in.
Tara and Mike Wicker there with Louisiana Black Advocates for Life, and they join us today here on Dear Jane. If you follow pro-life politics at all, and you kind of keep your eye on pro-life leaders, you'll know that the state of Louisiana has a handful of pro-life Black leaders, and even in some cases, pro-life Black Democrats, believe it or not. So I gotta ask Tara and Mike, what's in the water in Louisiana, and how can we replicate that around the rest of the country?
It's interesting because we've been asked that question quite a bit, and it's Louisiana, of course, has its own unique culture and style and doing a lot of things, and politics is no different than that. Yeah. And we just did not, until we were traveling nationally and really being involved in this conversation, we didn't realize that the mix that we had here in Louisiana was just staunchly different than what other people were experiencing. So it was kind of second nature to us. We didn't really think about it. It just was kind of part of our culture of who we are. And if you are a Christian, in Louisiana, in the Bible Belt.
Yeah, I think that really was got it. The Bible, with us being in the center of the Bible Belt, even though you have people that lean Democratic because some social issues that are concerning, there's not really a lot of the morality issues that you would think of, but because of socioeconomic issues, different issues, but they're still Christian. And so when it came down to even our Democratic senators and Democratic representatives, a lot of them, they were still leaning and voting pro-life.
And one of the things that we also found is, as far as especially our age generation, I think that it was more of sort of a culture. It wasn't really a thought of, I'm going to go in here and actually register Democrat, register Republican necessarily because of even a whole lot of the backdrop. Mm-hmm. It was more of sort of a passing down of tradition from family member to family member, or generation to generation. Yeah. So it was kind of like, you don't even think about it. You just do what your parents did. And so I think that also was culturally kind of part of it. That's interesting because the dynamics of this newer generation is they are very much more independent, much more fluid, and have their own mindset of and ideologies about party lines and where they're going to line up. So it is an interesting dynamic, but it is changing too.
Yeah.
I'm curious how the landscape has changed in Louisiana since the Dobbs decision. Because my understanding is abortion is totally illegal in the state now. I'm sure that abortions are still happening, unfortunately, but how has that changed the nature of y'all's work?
You want to go?
Well, I think the nature is still, we're very heavy on the educational piece. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, part of what we do with Louisiana Black Advocates for Life is we go out into the different communities, and we thought we was going to have an easy job when we got to the church, because we're like, oh man, it's going to be easy. You know, as a pastor and first lady, we really thought it was going to be easy. But when we got into the politics of it, some of the people, you know, were fighting political things. And so, you know, the mission is still very much so alive of coming in and make sure we're educating, re-educating, and reteaching about the horrible atrocity of what abortion really is and what really goes on. And I think when we do that, it really changes the heartbeat of some of the communities.
Yeah, and I think with the overturning of Roe versus Wade, obviously it was just like much of the nation, there was this sort of wake-up moment. Even here in Louisiana, of course, we were part of the trigger law. We had already anticipated that at some point in time, did not know when and if it was even going to happen in our lifetime, but fully was in expectation that one day that would be overturned. And so there was this expectation there. But at the same time, I think that, you know, because the way that we did it is, of course, once that happened, then automatically it became illegal. So we had always been working towards that end. But I think there was an awakeness and a more of an awareness of, okay, this is really happening. So even people that have been on the fence and had been really nonverbal or indifferent in this situation, we found were forced into having to pick sides.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have a political background. Obviously I served on the Baton Rouge City Council for 12 years and served as a city manager for the city of Baton Rouge in the mayor's office. So politics is not anything that's new to us. However, as Mike mentioned, politics in the church in that aspect, I have to admit, we were a little naive because we just assumed this was going to be a great movement. And when we had to sit down and have basic conversations with pastors about this is not a political issue, this is a human issue. And by the way, this is what the Bible says about life. Mm-hmm. We had to change everything that we thought we were going to do and readjust our strategy in terms of how we were going to get the message out in the community. So that for us, I think, was the major shift.
That was. And then, of course, to the forefront came the hard cases, you know, rape and incest and all of these different things. And so, you know, just re-educating and teaching along those lines of, yes, that's a horrible situation. Yes, this is something we're dealing with, but, you know, we don't want to ever put a woman who has went through a horrible situation into another horrible situation and really educate and enlighten everybody on that. That becomes the big deal.
But I got to tell you one other quick thing. I know we're going long in answering this question, but it's at the heart of what we talk about all the time, because we launched My Baby's Closet, which was one of our strategies of how do we engage the churches without having to have them, you know, even pastors that wanted to be able to support moms and babies and families, but was very uncomfortable with having this conversation about abortion. So we kind of allowed for that conversation to happen about, well, you know, let's support the moms and the babies. Let's provide diapers and wipes and formulas and things of that sort as an open door to this larger conversation. And it was interesting because when we started doing My Baby's Closet, we launched it in local community centers, local churches, and we had folk that were on the other side of the aisle on this issue that said, hey, we want to support, we want to bring diapers and wipes, we want to participate in that drive. And it was an interesting conversation with one of my friends who's a state rep, and she's on the other side of the aisle, but we're friends. And I told her, I said, you know, it's interesting because that same little baby that you're giving those diapers and wipes to that's 2 months old, that was the same little baby that, you know, a little while ago was in his mama's womb. That's and right. So it brings the human side to it in a very unique way of doing that. So that was interesting too, in terms of how we were able to unite along party lines, even with something as simple as diapers and wipes and formula for babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just as an aside here, and I don't want to create a rift within your relationship, but I see a significant. So Mike, what state are you in?
We're in Louisiana.
Tara, what state are you in?
We're in Louisiana.
Oh, now I heard Louisiana.
That's
at one
country
point.
And city. That's Louisiana. Country and city. So, yeah,
I was like, wait a second.
All in Louisiana.
I'm a city girl. I'm a city girl. So we were laughing because when we were teenagers, he took me to the country for one of the first times in my life, and there were the birds out there were like blue and red, and there were all these different colors. And I'm like, wow, that's interesting because the city birds are just brown. Yeah. Even in the same, I didn't even realize that. God, we've been together forever. You're the first one that ever picked up.
I had to give you a hard time. That's all right.
That's all right.
So it seems to me we're talking about, it's really interesting because we're talking about two groups here in a way. We're talking about pastors who want to be, I mean, we run into this a lot. Pastors who want to be more vocal on the life issue,
yes.
they're hesitant to do so for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
So I want to talk on that, but then also within the Black community from a larger perspective, it's just really, really, it seems like it's really, really hard to be a Black leader who's very much pro-life. Why is that?
Well, I'll tap on the first one about the pastors. Okay. Issue with them, and it's two parts. You have some that want to engage, but they can't or won't, or the church has been really mute on this subject, especially the African-American church. The Black church has been mute on it. And before I really got involved in, and we come out of a non-denominational church that was very pro-life, that was very large in participating and had, participated in marches and everything every year. But outside of that, in the Black church in particular, I never saw that, never heard of it. And as we got into this particular field and this issue of pursuing life and teaching life, we found out that some have been on the fence because they've never taught about it. They've never spoken about it. And so getting past their guilt or the shame or the ones that may have participated in abortion, getting past those issues, getting to the heart of healing, I think people are more open to start communicating, getting engaged, moving past their own personal issues in it.
And I think it's just, again, going back to culture, because we know the statistics show that abortions happen at a much more disproportionate rate than it does in the Caucasian community. But it's also, we found, the least talked about issue. And so, and that had been sort of just culturally in the Black community. For instance, I remember when I was a young kid, if someone, was diagnosed with cancer, they wouldn't even say the word. They would like, it's kind of a whisper. Like no one would ever talk about it. So, when you compound on top of that, all of the healthcare disparities and all the things that go along with this larger conversation, abortion has really been treated in a sense like cancer. We know it's happening. We know it's happening at an alarming rate. We don't really know or not really informed on how to deal with it. So we just kind of push that under the rug. It's something that's horrible that happens, but we don't talk about it. So we intentionally go into situations and try to make people comfortable having uncomfortable conversations. And so it's nothing more that we found other than culture. And then compounded on top of that has been now this whole issue where it's become politicized. So now you have the Republicans that are, talking about being pro-life. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Democrats that have fielded over to say pro-choice. Well, when you drill it all down, it really doesn't make sense at all. But that's kind of the further disparity. And it's hidden under, well, you don't really care about our communities. You just care about getting the babies born. But what happens to the babies once they're here?
Yeah.
And so that's why we're here, because this is more of a whole life issue. More than just, yes, it's important to get the babies here, but it does also bring relevance to what happens to those little babies and those families once they're here. And that's
so,
a larger conversation.
It's been a two-part deal, and especially with the black communities, because some people we can approach have sensible dialogue, and some people we have to have very confrontational,
intentional
dialogue. Yeah. You know, when I come and talk about eugenics, and I come and talk about how Planned Parenthood has been weaponized against the Black community, mm-hmm. and I talk about, you know, and it's really an aha, you know, does Black, you know, lives really matter, you know, mm-hmm. if you're doing this and doing this and not. So when we have those type of conversations, we're able to move past the fact that the perception that, okay, this is just a Republican Party issue. This is just a older white man issue that they don't want me to do. No, this is a human life issue we're talking about. And so we have to have those conversations on both sides of the globe to say, no, we're in it for, you know, I'm concerned about that baby from the womb to the tomb.
Yeah. And it's also an age issue. There's an age disparity in terms of how people view this conversation. So we do HBCU tours where we go on college campuses and intentionally have these conversations with the younger population. And you can literally see the aha moments. And it's been transformative for us, because when we start having the conversations about the intentional reduction of the population, the race population based on eugenics and history and all of that, and then we are able to support that with backings of statistics on abortion, yep. you can see their minds open. You can see their eyes, you know, get really big, and you could also see their hearts melt. Mm-hmm. And the most prominent conversations that we've had or comments that we had is, we just didn't know. Like, nobody ever told us this. Mm-hmm. So we're very intentional of going in and being truthful about it. But we've also found that you've got to allow them to have their own self-discovery. Some people get there and they still stay in their own space and place. But most people that we've exposed to the truth yeah. have said, oh my God, I just didn't know.
You know,
you changed my views.
You know, I think about, you know, several of the historical Black colleges that we've had these large meetings at and talked about. It's never has been not one college that we've had students at the end that came in. I came in here pro-choice.
Yeah.
But I can't say that I'm that anymore. You know, so it has, it's really
it's
education.
Changing.
It's really
mm-hmm.
changing up the heart. After information
one person
is
at
really
a time.
One person mm-hmm. at a time. Really.
Yeah. That's amazing. So I was going to ask about that, because we've done, you know, there's tons of research out there about how Planned Parenthood targets Black communities and Black babies. So I was curious if you guys touched on that. And so I'm glad you brought that up. And I'm curious what the next step is. So after people, they've had that awareness raised, they realize, oh my gosh, like, we've been targeted. What's usually the next step? Do they want to get plugged in to pro-life ministry? Is that just, you know, information for them to have, and they talk to their friends about it? What happens next usually?
Yeah, it varies. So part of it is, you know, again, you know, the identification that this is an issue. Mm-hmm. So we intentionally have those conversations so that they can go home and around the supper table, or, you know, in their dorm rooms or with their friends and families on Christmas holidays. Now they're able to engage in this political conversation in a much more informed manner. But in addition to that, we try to make sure that there are opportunities, and we really do this with the pastors
yep.
too. So we have luncheons where we do further education. For instance, we did a panel discussion at Southern University, and I'll never forget, one of the local pastors participated, and he was kind of on the fence because I had known him for a long time and really didn't know where he stood. And he came to the event, and when I tell you, he left there so fired up. We were out of town, and he calls us on the phone, and he's really associated with a very large Baptist association that goes all across the country. And he was so frustrated, and he kept saying, I can't believe that these are ministers of the gospel, and when they're exposed to the truth, they still just don't accept the truth. And so he called us for talking points. So we provide information. These are the statistics. This is the short version. We have a pastor's playbook. That and every year, in celebration of Roe versus Wade being overturned in June, Mike presents the pastors with a sermon for that mm-hmm. Sunday to say, this is how you preach
and
that.
So we stand
message.
In solidarity. And I've had to, you know, kind of disguise it a little bit. So we call it Love Life Sunday.
Yes.
You know? And so Love Life Sunday, we preach it. And really come out of the scripture where Jesus took care of the widows and the orphans. He told us it. So, but, you know, a big portion of it is preaching on pro-life issues. And then from there, taking care of people from the womb to the tomb. We're responsible for being, creating those safe places, those safe havens for moms and babies and fathers, really, you know, because I don't want to leave out the fathers, you know. Right. Because a lot of times people focus in on mom and baby and never focus in on the mental trauma that's going on inside the father. You know, we've experienced that.
Yeah. And I think too, coming out of, again, a political background, we know the relevance and the acceptance of resolutions and proclamations and things of that sort. So one of the things that we've done, and that also has been supported by bipartisan. So we've had Democratic and Republican legislators that during Love Life Sunday, everybody wants to sign their name on that certificate and that resolution. And so we actually provide those resolutions to the pastors that are standing with us in solidarity to support life. And so that's been really great. And we give them this big old red heart that has life and love. And well, it says love, of course, the heart, and then it has life. And so you pass through the churches and through the communities, and that's a sign that they're involved in the movement. So we've had to be, again, very strategic, very creative about having those conversations. But it's working. We've found.
Mike, you brought it up. Young men. I mean, how do we black, white, doesn't matter, really. I mean, how do we get these guys to understand? I mean, I feel like if we can get these guys to understand their role in all of this,
yeah,
we can make a lot of ground. That's the million-dollar question. Yeah. How do we do that?
Yeah, you know, it to me, it all comes back to the scripture, you know, and so we start there. And, you know, a lot of times I give them the scripture that Jesus said, you know, don't forbid the children to come. Let them come unto me, you know, suffer not, let the children come. And so we'll start there. And then, you know, outside of getting them to accept responsibility of understanding, I've never seen a lady create a baby by herself, and you know that baby is yours, so you need to be involved in the decision. Because a lot of them will come and say, well it was her decision, it was her choice, I don't know, you know. And it's easy to fall into the rhetoric that you hear out there, my body, my choice, all of this stuff. But when the voice is silent, because when we were, you know, younger, we experienced that, an abortion, you know, inside of our relationship when we were 16 years old. First time Tara had ever had sex, we got pregnant. I was telling an old girlfriend about what had happened, that I couldn't be with her anymore. Tara kind of drove by and saw us, and she thought something different, thought that I was still talking to a girl or whatever. It had been a couple of weeks since we had talked. And when she came back, she told me that, you know, mom had taken her and she had had an abortion. I didn't even know, like I said, I was a country boy. I didn't even know what an abortion was. I had to look it up. But there was a temporary moment of, okay, I don't have to deal with the responsibility of this. But it was a temporary moment of responsibility that I don't have to deal with this. But at the same time, the sadness that happened into me for years of not being able, and I'm a real, we have six kids, you know, we're married with six kids, and I've been a man's man, a father of fathers, with spiritual sons and daughters, but not being able to father that child was the mental torment in that, and the heartbreak of not having a voice as a father is heartbreaking. So you have to get them involved. And so even when we've been out on the front lines, out when the clinics were open, telling those men, man, you're making the worst mistake of your life, man. Do not do this. What are you doing? You know, I mean, it's...
That's your baby.
That's your baby.
And I think we've had to be very creative in that space as well, because it's really twofold. So, you have dads that we found that are wanting to have a voice, but because of the fact that they're not carrying the baby and,
right.
you know, the culture has told them that that's, you know, she's carrying the yep. baby, that's her baby, you don't really have a voice. And we tell them half of that baby is yours. Like, she didn't make the baby by herself. And so the frustrating thing for us is the laws are not on the side of the dads either, because mm-hmm. if he wants to be able to keep his baby, he's really a victim in the sense because he doesn't have even the legal ability to say, you know, and I know that there are some laws and people are working on that, but what, you know, what right do I have to save my own baby? And so that's a whole nother voice that's out there that's silent because the voices of the fathers have been just, you know, snuffed out. They have not even been considered. And so you have that side. And then the other side is helping them to understand their role and the responsibility and the value of being a daddy and the impact that homes in the Black community are suffering from. Many of them have came from single parent homes where their dads weren't involved and they know the results of that. So bringing that stuff to light. So we did something very creative. We created something called Dad's University, where we're training, intentionally training Black Dads for Life. I'm sorry, Black Dads University, but training dads intentionally on and supporting them. Really, it's a support group for dads because a lot of times they don't feel like there's an avenue where they can be supported. And so on draft day, we happen to have a barbershop in Louisiana that's called Draft Picks. And so we intentionally had a draft night where they were able to come together, watch the draft, had a performer there, and they just sat around as guys talking
celebrated
about
fatherhood, you know, to the younger generation about and how important it is for them to engage and be involved. You know, before the civil rights movement and, of course, before Roe versus Wade, there was a large number, the exact opposite, especially in the African-American community, where 7 out of 10 homes are single parent homes now. 7 out of 10 homes then were homes with fathers in them. And of course, our abortion numbers were minimal. We didn't have any because, you know, the things, and I really believe health, they were lower, you know, but I believe that the cure to all of this is strong, healthy families. And so we're promoting that and teaching that and teaching fathers to get engaged, because I found out the more young ladies that have the boyfriend or the father of that baby involved, more likely or not, they won't choose abortion as an option.
We didn't know what the response was going to be from our college kids, but that question came up about, you know, why do you think there's so many abortions that are happening in the Black community? And we had an array of conversation about it. But one of the things that we obviously promote is the healthy building of a solid family unit. And so we said, you know, we believe folk are not getting married anymore, you know? And so marriage is one of those key antidotes to ending or significantly reducing abortion, because you don't see a whole lot of married folk lined up at the abortion clinic.
Really don't.
So then with a message like that, and because I've seen that before, it's like, we've got to help people understand the value of family.
Yep.
But who are we messaging? I mean, who are we telling that to? Because I would think a single mom saying, yeah, I believe you. I mean, how can we effectively communicate that message that it's a family, a nuclear family, for lack of a better term, is really beneficial, the most beneficial for everyone involved? Well, how can we do that?
I think that you just demonstrate that all children deserve to have the benefit of having a mom and a dad.
Yep.
And not that, now Mike and I both grew up in single family homes. Mike's father was killed in an accident when he was 5 years old. My mom and dad divorced when I was 5 years old, or separated when I was 5 years old, divorced when I was 6. So both of us at that time in our lives, very critical moments, found ourselves without dads. And so I think the value of being able to, number one, support those single moms, because the unfortunate thing is, even as single moms, they're still in many instances sexually active, and they're still out there getting pregnant. And so it just kind of exasperates that whole trail and that whole process. So number one, helping to support her in that process while very tenderly helping her to understand what is the best scenario for these children and for you. and at the same time promoting, especially in our younger people that are now making decisions about, am I going to get married, or, you know, how long am I going to remain single? Do I even believe in marriage? Mm-hmm. And helping them to understand that there is value in a marital unit.
You know, we were involved in a program that was developed by Dr. John and Julie Gottman through the Gottman's Institute many years ago. And we taught it locally about building stronger families, building stronger families. And the whole purpose of that was
had to be the biological parents of the child.
The biological parents of the child was that was the ingredient. But we taught them relationship building skills. And at the end of the program, of the 18 weeks they went through, was teaching them choosing marriage as a viable option. Now, years later, this was many years ago we taught that, but I still see a lot of those families still together because they got the right relationship skills.
You know? Now, in those instances, the focus was on the child. Your child is going to fare better if you have a good, viable relationship. Right. Whether you get married or not, obviously we wanted them to choose marriage as a viable option, but that wasn't the whole focus. The focus was get along, let's teach you skills on how to make sure this child has a good life.
Has the best. That child, more than he wants Jordans or a PlayStation, he wants a good relationship between his mom and dad.
Yep.
We need Wickers in every state of the Union. I don't know how we do it, but that's the first thing we need to do. If you are a Black leader or your pastor, you like what we're talking about, you need to check out the website, LA Black Advocates, LA Black Advocates. And of course, we know now that LA stands for Louisiana. And
so Louisiana.
That's you guys are doing great work. We really, really appreciate you, what you're doing. And anytime we can help spread the word, and we just love it. It's so important. And thanks for giving us some time today.
Thank you so much. And just to let you know, we do have National Black Advocates for Life. So we are now nationwide. So if you we're in every city. So if you need resources or information, we'd love to come and support and be involved.
Yes. So needed. So needed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.